Chapter 68. Business had taken Herbert on a journey to Marseille. I was alone, and had a dull sense of being alone. Dispirited and anxious, long hoping that tomorrow, or next week would clear my way, and long disappointed, I sadly missed the cheerful face, and ready response of my friend. It was wretched weather, stormy and wet, and mud, 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 deep in all the streets. Day after day, a vast heavy veil had been driving over London from the east, and it drove still, as if in the east there were an eternity of cloud and wind. So furious had been the gusts, that high buildings in town had had the lead stripped off their roofs, and in the country, trees had been torn up, and sails of windmills carried away, and gloomy accounts had come in from the coast, of shipwreck and death. Violent blasts of rain had accompanied these rages of wind, and the day just closed as I sat down to read, had been the worst of all. Alterations have been made in that part of the temple since that time, and it is not now so lonely a character as it had then, nor is it so exposed to the river. We lived at the top of the last house, and the wind rushing up the river, shook the house that night, like discharges of cannon, or breakings of AC. When the rain came with it and dashed against the windows, I thought, raising my eyes to them as they rocked, that I might have fancied myself in a storm-beaten lighthouse. Occasionally, the smoke came rolling down the chimney, as though it could not bear to go out into such a night. And when I set the doors open and looked down the staircase lamps were blown out, and when I shaded my face with my hands, and looked through the black windows, opening them ever so little, was out of the question in the teeth of such wind and rain, I saw, that the lamps in the court were blown out, and that the lamps on the bridges and the shore were shuddering, and that the coal fires in barges on the river, were being carried away before the wind like red hot splashes in the rain. I read with my watch upon the table, purposing to close my book at 11 o'clock. As I shut it, St. Paul's, and all the many church clocks in the city, some leading, some accompanying, some following, struck that hour. The sound was curiously flawed by the wind, and I was listening, and thinking how the wind assailed and tore it, when I heard a footstep on the stair. What nervous folly made me start, and awfully connected with the footstep of my dead sister, matters not. It was past in a moment, and I listened again, and heard the footstep stumble in coming on. Remembering then, that the staircase lights were blown out, I took up my reading lamp, and went out to the stairhead. Whoever was below had stopped on seeing my lamp, for all was quiet. "There is someone down there, is there not?" I called out, looking down. "Yes," said a voice from the darkness beneath. "What floor do you want?" "The top." "Mr. Pip." "That is my name." "There is nothing the matter?" "Nothing the matter," returned the voice. And the man came on. I stood with my lamp held out over the stair rail, and he came slowly within its light. It was a shaded lamp, to shine upon a book, and its circle of light was very contracted, so that he was in it for a mere instant, and then out of it. In the instant, I had seen a face, that was strange to me, looking up with an incomprehensible air of being touched, and pleased by the sight of me. Moving the lamp as the man moved, I made out, that he was substantially dressed, but roughly, like a voyager by sea. That he had long iron gray hair. That his age was about 60. That he was a muscular man, strong on his legs, and that he was browned and hardened by exposure to weather. As he ascended the last stair or two, and the light of my lamp included us both, I saw, with a stupid kind of amazement, that he was holding out both his hands to me. "Pray, what is your business?" I asked him. "My business?" he repeated, pausing. "Ah, yes. I will explain my business, by your leave. Do you wish to come in?" "Yes," he replied. "I wish to come in, master." I had asked him the question inhospitably enough, for I resented the sort of bright and gratified recognition that still shone in his face. I resented it, because it seemed to imply that he expected me to respond to it. But I took him into the room I had just left, and, having set the lamp on the table, asked him as civilly as I could to explain himself. He looked about him with the strangest air and air of wondering pleasure, as if he had some part in the things he admired, and he pulled off a rough outer coat and his hat. Then, I saw that his head was furrowed and bald, and that the long iron gray hair grew only on its sides. But, I saw nothing that in the least explained him. On the contrary, I saw him next moment, once more holding out both his hands to me. "What do you mean?" said I, half suspecting him to be mad. He stopped in his looking at me, and slowly rubbed his right hand over his head. "It's disappointing to a man," he said, in a coarse broken voice, "arter having looked forward so distant, and come so fur. But you're not to blame for that, neither on us is to blame for that. I'll speak in half a minute. Give me half a minute, please." He sat down on a chair that stood before the fire, and covered his forehead with his large brown venous hands. I looked at him attentively then, and recoiled a little from him, but I did not know him. "There's no one nigh," said he, looking over his shoulder, "is there? Why do you, a stranger coming into my rooms at this time of the night, ask that question?" Said one. "You're a game one," he returned, shaking his head at me with a deliberate affection, at once most unintelligible and most exasperating. "I'm glad you've grown up, a game one. But don't catch hold of me. You'd be sorry arter words to have done it." I relinquished the intention he had detected, for I knew him. Even yet, I could not recall a single feature, but I knew him. If the wind and the rain had driven away the intervening years, had scattered all the intervening objects, had swept us to the churchyard, where we first stood face to face on such different levels, I could not have known my convict more distinctly than I knew him now as he sat in the chair before the fire. No need to take a file from his pocket and show it to me. No need to take the handkerchief from his neck and twist it round his head. No need to hug himself with both his arms and take a shivering turn across the room, looking back at me for recognition. I knew him before he gave me one of those aids, though, a moment before, I had not been conscious of remotely suspecting his identity. He came back to where I stood and again held out both his hands. Not knowing what to do, for, in my astonishment I had lost my self-possession, I reluctantly gave him my hands. He grasped them heartily, raised them to his lips, kissed them, and still held them. "You acted noble, my boy," said he. "Noble, Pip. And I have never forgot it." At a change in his manner, as if he were even going to embrace me, I laid a hand upon his breast, and put him away. "Stay," said one. "Keep off. If you are grateful to me for what I did when I was a little child, I hope you have shown your gratitude by mending your way of life. If you have come here to thank me, it was not necessary. Still, however you have found me out, there must be something good in the feeling that has brought you here, and I will not repulse you. But surely you must understand that my attention was so attracted by the singularity of his fixed look at me, that the words died away on my tongue. You was a saying," he observed, "when we had confronted one another in silence, that surely I must understand." "What, surely must I understand?" "That I cannot wish to renew that chance intercourse with you of long ago, under these different circumstances. I am glad to believe you have repented and recovered yourself. I am glad to tell you so. I am glad that, thinking I deserve to be thanked, you have come to thank me. But our ways are different ways, nonetheless. You are wet, and you look weary. Will you drink something before you go?" He had replaced his neckerchief loosely, and had stood, keenly observant of me, biting a long end of it. "I think," he answered, still with the end at his mouth and still observant of me, "that I will drink, I thank you, afore I go." There was a tray ready on a side table. I brought it to the table near the fire, and asked him what he would have. He touched one of the bottles without looking at it or speaking, and I made him some hot rum and water. I tried to keep my hand steady while I did so, but his look at me as he leaned back in his chair with the long draggled end of his neckerchief between his teeth evidently forgotten made my hand very difficult to master. When at last I put the glass to him, I saw with amazement that his eyes were full of tears. Up to this time I had remained standing, not to disguise that I wished him gone. But I was softened by the softened aspect of the man, and felt a touch of reproach. "I hope," said I, hurriedly putting something into a glass for myself, and drawing a chair to the table, "that you will not think I spoke harshly to you just now. I had no intention of doing it, and I am sorry for it if I did. I wish you well, and happy." As I put my glass to my lips, he glanced with surprise at the end of his neckerchief, dropping from his mouth when he opened it, and stretched out his hand. I gave him mine, and then he drank, and drew his sleeve across his eyes and forehead. "How are you living?" I asked him. "I've been a sheep farmer, stock breeder, other trades besides, away in the New World," said he. "Many a thousand mile of stormy water off from this. I hope you have done well?"
"I've done wonderfully well. There's others went out alonger me as has done well too, but no man has done nigh as well as me. I'm famous for it."
"I am glad to hear it. I hope to hear you say so, my dear boy." Without stopping to try to understand those words, or the tone in which they were spoken, I turned off to a point that had just come into my mind. "Have you ever seen a messenger you once sent to me," I inquired, "since he undertook that trust?"
"Never set eyes upon him. I weren't likely to it. He came faithfully, and he brought me the 2 £1 notes. I was a poor boy then, as you know, and to a poor boy they were a little fortune. But, like you, I have done well since, and you must let me pay them back. You can put them to some other poor boy's use." I took out my purse. He watched me as I laid my purse upon the table and opened it, and he watched me as I separated 2 £1 notes from its contents. They were clean and new, and I spread them out and handed them over to him. Still watching me, he laid them one upon the other, folded them longwise, gave them a twist, set fire to them at the lamp, and dropped the ashes into the tray. "May I make so bold," he said then, with a smile that was like a frown, and with a frown that was like a smile, "as ask you how you have done well, since you and me was out on them lone shivering marshes?"
"How?"
"Ah." He emptied his glass, got up, and stood at the side of the fire, with his heavy brown hand on the mantel shelf. He put a foot up to the bars, to dry and warm it, and the wet boot began to steam. But he neither looked at it, nor at the fire, but steadily looked at me. It was only now that I began to tremble. When my lips had parted, and had shaped some words that were without sound, I forced myself to tell him, though I could not do it distinctly, that I had been chosen to succeed to some property.
"Might a mere woman ask what property?" said he. I faltered, "I don't know."
"Might a mere woman ask whose property?" said he. I faltered again, "I don't know."
"Could I make a guess, I wonder," said the convict, "at your income since you come of age?"
"As to the first figure now."
"5?
With my heart beating like a heavy hammer of disordered action, I rose out of my chair, and stood with my hand upon the back of it, looking wildly at him.
"Concerning a guardian," he went on. "There ought to have been some guardian, or such like, whiles you was a minor. Some lawyer, maybe. As to the first letter of that lawyer's name now, would it be J?" All the truth of my position came flashing on me, and its disappointments, dangers, disgraces, consequences of all kinds, rushed in such a multitude, that I was borne down by them, and had to struggle for every breath I drew.
"Put it," he resumed, "as the employer of that lawyer whose name begun with a J, and might be Jaggers, put it as he had come oversea to Portsmouth, and had landed there, and had wanted to come on to you. However, you have found me out, apostrophe you says just now. Well, however, did I find you out? Why, I wrote from Portsmouth to a person in London, for particulars of your address. That person's name? Why, Wemmick. I could not have spoken one word, though it had been to save my life. I stood, with a hand on the chair back, and a hand on my breast, where I seemed to be suffocating. I stood so, looking wildly at him, until I grasped at the chair, when the room began to surge and turn. He caught me, drew me to the sofa, put me up against the cushions, and bent on one knee before me, bringing the face, that I now well remembered, and that I shuddered at, very near to mine. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.